Blog Talk Radio.
With Miss E. I know every week I come on, I say, this is something that's close to my heart, or this is something that just resonates with me, or I'm excited, and this is a very special guest. Well, you know what? Even if I say it every time, it's true, because I'm thankful that I love what I do, and that every guest that I have has something to say that basically validates the message that I want to put out to the world. And who can tell it better than they themselves? So our guest tonight, I'm not going to prolong because there is so much to be discussed, and I have talked already for like 2 hours about this interview and about the guest and about the book. And if there are foster and adoptive parents out there or professionals in the field, you may be more familiar with this topic than the general population. However, it is something that the whole village really needs to be aware of. I know some of my comments may be somewhat controversial in the professional community, and that's because I've lived on both sides of this, both as the professional and both as the caregiver. So tonight's topic is actually, well, I'm going to tell you what the call is, what I've entitled the call. It is called What's at the Heart of and After a Psychiatric Diagnosis for Children? What's at the heart of and after a psychiatric diagnosis for children? And being in the mental health field, our children are given lots of labels and diagnoses, and I feel that there are reasons why sometimes that are not necessarily beneficial to the child, we give them labels. But we'll talk about that a little later. But under every diagnosis, under every symptom or behavior, there is something else. And that, in my perspective, always has to deal with the heart. That is, unless, but even if there is, a neurological, a biological, a biochemical issue going on, I believe that everything goes right back to the heart of the child. So let's not prolong this introduction. Our guest tonight is the author of the newly released book, and actually I think I'm the first to be able to do an interview because I think the book was just released last week. The author is Mr. Jesse Hoxett, and the title of his book is Detached, Surviving Reactive Attachment Disorder, A Personal Story. Jesse, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, gosh, I appreciate your being here, and there is so much I am so excited about tonight, and it wasn't until I actually met you and then got the book and read it, and actually would have read it in one day if I had the time, but read it basically in two settings and really had a difficulty putting it down because of just so many of the things that I recognized. So first of all, before you tell your history, tell our listeners, what is reactive attachment disorder, or as we call it by short, RAD?
Well, reactive attachment disorder comes about from when a child who's very young, from birth till around age 5, that's when the child absorbs a lot of information like a sponge. That's when they learn to love. They learn to trust. They know what appropriate boundaries are. They're starting to learn those. And the way reactive attachment disorder comes about, if at any point if that child's abused or neglected or passed around from home to home, whether it be foster homes or whether people coming in and out of the home, and they're not given a stable environment to live. They're not given the nurture and comfort by their mother or their father, and therefore they have to find ways of getting their needs met. For example, when I was a child, my mother was really gone all the time. She was never there in the picture, other than what I thought to be, you know, the normal motherly duties of what she thought. So I was never really given affection. We were left alone at nighttime by ourselves. We had to fend for ourselves for food and things like that, severely abused and neglected. So as a child gets older, they learn these coping skills on how to get their needs met whatever and wherever possible. So they'll do things such as manipulation, such as stealing, such as lying, and it just gets progressively worse from there.
Okay. And so the bottom line with this, how does this affect the child and their relationships?
The child has a very hard time in forming relationships with anybody. They can't get close to anybody because they can't trust anybody. They're not used to having one or two people in their life as a stability figure. So as they get older, they have a hard time with relationships. If they're put into foster care and later adopted, they have a hard time getting close to the adoptive parents. A lot of times, if it's a single, you know, biological mother or biological father, more than that, when they're put into a foster care or adopted, that child may get close to the father if they've never had a father before, or they may get close to the mother if they've never had a mother before. So it makes it very hard for them to develop good relationships with people and have those appropriate boundaries.
Okay. So you mentioned your childhood, but let's first start with, at what age were you when you were given this diagnosis?
I was age 12 when I was given that diagnosis, and the way I got that diagnosis is my mom, my adoptive mom, my mother, who I love very much, actually saw a show on TV, and it started talking about reactive attachment disorder. And then she started to ask questions. She's very smart. She wanted to know what was going on. She had the best of intentions for me. And she started asking a lot of questions. And then she spoke to our family therapist and psychiatrist, and they later confirmed that was a diagnosis. And the therapist is the one who told me about the diagnosis. Now, when I found out about it, it didn't make any sense to me. I didn't know what it was. It was really not important to me. I thought I was fine the way I was. So naturally, anything somebody told me, or if you have reactive attachment disorder, or if you have oppositional defiant disorder, that I had no idea what that meant. To me, I was normal, but I had some issues I knew that I had to work on.
So it had no significance to you, really?
Correct.
Okay, because a lot of times I think we try to explain things to kids and explain to them the way they are, and it's like, yes, and?
Right,
so
exactly.
So some of your behaviors, actually, as going through the book, I'm looking through and seeing that some of your behaviors were lying, stealing, cutting, soiling, having no empathy or remorse for your behaviors, nor, you know, concern about other people's needs. And I think those are just the primary, the basic ones that really caused the greatest problems in your life. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. My behavior started out as lying. I, with reactive attachment disorder, we're going to get what we want with any means necessary, by any means necessary. And so I would lie to get my way, almost kind of like the manipulation aspect. If I did something wrong, I didn't know it was affecting the other person. We don't have any concept of, you know, what we're doing is wrong. We're just out to get our needs met, plain and simple, bottom line. If we're caught on it, we're going to lie about it. And then it went to stealing. Okay, I had a hard time with friendships in elementary school, and it got really severe in junior high school. I was so desperately trying to fit in. I was also, you know, born with fetal alcohol syndrome, and so I was trying to do things that I thought was cool. I thought, you know, hanging out with certain people, taking things that I wasn't supposed to have to hold on, such as items that maybe cigarettes or maybe lighters or something, something to prove that I was cool, so to get people to like me. And then I found money. Now, as they say, money is the root of all evil. Now, in this case, I was stealing money from my parents left and right. It started small, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there, thinking they wouldn't notice. And then I would start stealing $50 bills, $20 bills, $100 bills, go to school and start passing out this money to people who I wanted to like me. And it worked. I suddenly became popular in school. Obviously, I'm handing out money, so naturally everybody's going to flock to where the money's at. And I liked the attention. I loved it. I was no longer this kid who was by himself, who felt alone, who so desperately needed to fit in. I was this kid who now is popular. But the problem is, as you do things for so long, you're going to get caught, and that happened to me. I got caught. The school found out. They called my parents, and that was it. The game was up. And then I went to the cutting. I first started cutting my clothes out of anger. You know, why? Because, you know, my mother, she would give me clothes. Now, I already had a biological mother in my mind. There was nobody going to take her place. I was waiting for my biological to come get me. I was promised she was going to come get me. She told me she was going to come get me. So anything that my mother, Suzanne, gave me, I would tear up. Out of anger, I'd start cutting holes in my clothes. Well, that led to making cuts on myself in places that my parents would not see. And watching the blood come out and cutting, I didn't feel the sting. I didn't feel the pain. Instead, it was all this anger inside that was just flowing out. As the blood trickled out, that was the anger coming out. And that's just the rage and hate and the anger that I had inside me at the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the average person, not knowing anything about reactive attachment disorder and not having been on that side of it, what is the perception that the average adult especially would have of a child that's doing all of these things?
Well, I can tell you from experience working with kids like this now, is that adults may see a child who's acting out as a bad child. In fact, I think the majority of adults out there may see a child acting out like that as a bad child and may question the parents. Hey, are you not raising this child right? You must be bad parents because my child doesn't do this. Why is your child doing that? And that's where a lot of the blame gets set in, and I hear it a lot from families is, you know, their friends or people on the street are looking at them and you know, you can tell they're thinking something on their mind like, those must be bad parents, but that's not the case. For, like you said earlier, for every action a child does, for every diagnosis that a child's given, there's something deeper going on. In that child, and that's what we have to do. We have to get back to the root of the problem and figure out what's going on with this child. Try to research what happened in their past. We can cover it up with medications, but all that's doing is covering up their behavior. That's not addressing the deeper issue that's going on inside, and that's what we need to figure out.
Exactly. You hit it right on the nose, and that's my whole thing, is to get people to have a different perspective, a different perception of who our young people are. People look and they, you know, look at them with disgust or, you know, in bitterment. And granted, when you're on the caregiver side and you're giving the best you can, it can be very disguarding and discouraging. But at the same time, they're still our children. And we need to understand, and we always, you know, I hear a lot of people say, well, that just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make sense to you, but, and even the child may not be consciously aware of it, but these things are going on. One of the things, and after we talk a little bit about where all this started with you, it's funny because, you know, when I speak, I talk about caring with heart, you know, and loving kids with heart, and the H is often humor. And someone said, well, this is serious. Ain't nothing funny about this. But I think the reality is We have to find the humor. And I actually tagged some of the pages in your book that I actually found to be hilarious. Now, of course, I know if I was in them in the moment, they would not be funny, but I managed to be able to do that. And sometimes, as a fostered adopted parent myself, I was, but it had to be, I had to be a little bit removed from the situation. But I want people to be able to stand back and look at it. And I think the key thing is one of the recommendations that you made at the end is don't take everything so personally. And that's
right.
It. And when you personalize it, some of this stuff is funny as heck, because I was looking at it and I said, okay, we had a little Dennis the Menace here. And smart. See, we missed that part. Jumping ahead of the game. Pardon me?
Yeah, in fact, you mentioned the fact about being smart. It's funny that you mentioned that, because my parents did tell me they were at their wits' end. They had no idea what to do. No matter what they did, these behaviors kept going. And they actually talked to their therapist, I believe is who it was, and they said, you know what? Don't tell Jesse what's going to happen. Keep him guessing, because if you tell him what's going to happen, he's going to know exactly what to do and how to manipulate the whole situation, because they said he's one of the smartest kids that we came across. He knows what's going to happen before it's happened. He knows how to manipulate the situation, and he's going to get over on you every time if he knows ahead of time what's going on. So they told my parents, keep changing it up. Don't let them know what's going on. Yeah.
And I will say that, just to jump in, and I'm sure that meant in terms of what consequences, you know, would be or where they were going to be, because I have another issue about not telling kids enough of what's going on that creates havoc within their little minds as well, you know, having a sense of security there. So you were diagnosed at the age of 12, and we've talked about a lot of the symptoms that you had while you were living, a lot of the behaviors that were displayed in living with your actually foster adopt parents, because they started off as foster parents and fell in love with you and decided to adopt you. So that was where you were at 12. But take us back to what happened after birth. You know, you talked about being born, I think you talked about being born premature, and with fetal alcohol syndrome, and there was another medical condition that you also endured. So tell us a little bit about the first, 4 years of your life.
Okay, well, I was born in February 19th, 1980. Now, my mother was single, as far as I knew. She was an alcoholic, and I was born with fetal alcohol syndrome. My heart stopped when I was born, but luckily the doctors were able to get it going again. I was also diagnosed with a condition called hydrocephalus, which is accumulation of cerebral spinal fluid in the head. And the way it works is you have that fluid in your head. It lubricates your brain. It lubricates your spinal cord. And it travels in the ventricles of the brain. And whenever one of those ventricles get blocked, the head will start accumulating all that fluid. It has nowhere to go, and your head can start to expand. You have seizures. You have a multitude of mental health problems of growing up. You may grow a little slower, and even death. And there's all kinds of other issues associated with that. There's different kinds of hydrocephalus. Mine was congenital hydrocephalus, meaning I had it since birth. They operated. They put what's called a VP shunt, a ventral peritoneal shunt, if I'm saying that right, pardon me, into my ventricle that was blocked, bypassed it just under my skin. They ran the tube and down into my peritoneal cavity where it was absorbed. That allowed me to function. That allowed my head to stay normal size. I did develop epilepsy due to it, which is seizures, grand mal seizures, which is real heavy-duty seizures of convulsions, and petit mal seizures, where I may just end up staring off into space and not realizing it, or eye twitching or whatnot. And I had 4 shunt revisions, which is pretty good. There's a lot of people I talk to who had over 10, over 20, over 30 shunt revisions. So I feel very lucky that I was only had 4. Now,
so you were hospitalized each of these times, right?
That's correct. And the hospital stay was approximately 3 days, 3 or 4 days.
Okay.
And most of the time they had to be replaced due to infection. One time the shunt actually broke apart and stopped working, so they had to go in there and fix it.
Mm.
So I was able to get through that. The last revision I remember was 4 years old, and came out of the hospital just fine, little, you know, headache and whatnot. But the doctor says, you know, you're going to have this the rest of your life. You're probably going to have more surgeries, and we don't know if you're going to live to be 21. Now, I didn't find out about the 21 until much, much, much many years later. But that was a prognosis for me. And so, okay, I thought, well, fine. It is what it is. You know, I went on with my life. Now, also, growing up, you said, from 0 to 4, with my mother, single mother, she had many people coming in and out of her life, okay? She was very unstable. She tried to work what job she could, whether it be at the local Bob's Big Boy restaurant or wherever she can get a job, she tried. I remember moving from place to place to place, and sometimes when my mother didn't have any means of support, we lived in a car, and it was my sister and I. And so finally, with the abuse from one of her boyfriends and the neglect and leaving us home at night to fend for ourselves, and that's another thing. We would fend for ourselves, and then when Mom got home with her boyfriend, we'd get in trouble for the messes we made. It made no sense to me, and I don't want to go in too much vivid detail about the abuse or not, but that was life. From 0 to 4, that was life for me, constantly on the move, uncertainty of what was going to happen, the neglect, the abuse, and the big thing, the instability and the inconsistency was huge. And so I was taken to a children's shelter in San Jose and dropped off there with my sister and I. And then we went into a home temporarily, which is a place for kids to go, which allows for the mother or the biological mother or biological father to be able to get their stuff straight, to be able to prove they can provide a home, prove they can provide stability, and then they would be able to come pick up the kids. That didn't happen. I was put in foster care. My sister was adopted out to a different family. Mm-hmm. They were still trying to find my biological father. In order for him to be able to sign his rights away. And also because I was Cherokee Indian, enough Cherokee Indian, they had to get permission from the Cherokee Council to say, hey, it's okay for him to be adopted. So I was a foster care child from age 5 up until around age 7 and shortly after to where the adoption became official.
Wow. So that all happened just during the prime time of child development. All of this trauma that you experienced, all of the unknowns and the lack of security and the lack of connectedness happened before you even turned 5 years old.
Right.
So a lot of times when people are taking in children, they expect that this child has had, you know, a quote-unquote normal beginning, and they have high
right.
expectations. One of the things that caught my eye was that in one of the, I think one was with a relative caregiver and the other was with the initial emergency foster parent, being upset not that you didn't know how to bathe yourself, that
right.
you had not come through very well with your toileting. And I hear a lot of caregivers say, well, they're such and such age, and they should know how to do this already. This child doesn't know anything. And it's like, well, if you were in that environment, I wonder how much would you know?
Right. And when a child's in that environment, they're kind of their process, their learning process is literally put on hold.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have that chance to be able to continue to excel in what they're supposed to learn between that age. A child should be potty trained, you know, 3, 3.5 years old, maybe 4 years old. You know, it depends on the child. But if there's any kind of trauma in between that time, their brain, from my experience, is literally going to stop. And that's why a lot of kids who are older now may not have had a childhood revert back to having a childhood because they've gotten to a point where they feel safe and secure that they're going to go back to where their life pretty much stopped and
mm-hmm.
begin having what they feel should be a normal life. I've worked with kids who are 17, 18 years old who like to snuggle with a blanket and hold a teddy bear and enjoy reading bedtime stories. Why? Because they were never given that at the age where they should be given that, and they're missing out on that. And so
mm-hmm.
that's perfectly normal. You know, and as far as the bathing issue goes, there's a lot like that. Also, what I found out, too, is with the soiling, such as I did, that is also a way, because we have a fear of getting close to somebody because of the trust, that's a way to keep people away. Nobody's going to want to come around us if we're soiling ourselves because, frankly, it smells too bad, you know. And so that's kind of a defense mechanism for us to keep people away, you know.
You know, that's interesting because I had not even looked at it that way because there are usually some other things that we look for in children when that type of behavior is going on. But interestingly enough, with my intern, we were even just talking about bedwetting. And, you know, enuresis is the urinating on self, and the encopresis is soiling, you know, with your bowel. And we were talking about what's going on with one of our kids. And one was to keep people away, and that way you knew you were safe. And all these years, that had not even occurred to me. So you're 5 years old, and you go to this home with these two people who adored you.
Yes.
What was it like going into that home?
It was very scary to me. Going to someplace new that you're not familiar with, especially with somebody who has reactive attachment disorder, it's very scary. There's a lot of anxiety involved. You don't know what to expect. You don't know if you can trust these people. You don't know when you go in the home if it's going to be safe. You don't know if there's going to be somebody else there. When I went there, I was told by my mother that Suzanne, my adopted mother, my mother, that she had some friends for me. So automatically I was like, okay, great. You know, there's other kids at the house I can get along with. So all the way to the house, I couldn't wait to meet these new kids. I get there. There was no kids there. It turned out to be the family cat. Well, you know, when you have expectations like that and you're going to an unfamiliar place, an unfamiliar environment, it's very scary, to say the least, especially when you're used to being with somebody else for so long, and used to being around noise and chaos and whatnot, you get used to that. So going to my mom and dad's place, it was very quiet, it was very peaceful, it was a new atmosphere, it was very scary. You know, I didn't know how to react to that at all.
What did you think of them initially?
I thought they were very funny. I thought they were really nice people. I had no idea I was going to be fostered by them and eventually adopted by them. So my initial reaction was, hey, I can hang out with these people. We played cards. You know, I cheated at cards. I was very smart. I always won. But my reaction was, I don't have to get close to these people. They're just here checking me out. You know, they want to play some cards. Great. I can manipulate them. I can win, and then that'll be it. You know, I had no idea that when they came to visit me at that one place I went to, that I would later become their foster child and ultimately they would become my new parents.
Right. So when you got to the home and you found out that you were going to be there for a while at least, did you think they were still funny? Before you started,
my attitude kind of changed a little bit. Yeah, the honeymoon phase kind of went quickly over because, again, my biological mother still had visitation. She would come and visit me at this place. She would call and said she would come but would never come. And this would happen on several occasions. So naturally, I thought I was there just long enough for her to come and get me and take me back where I belong. Even though all the abuse and all the neglect I had gone through, she was still my mother and nobody was going to replace that. At all.
Now, you say that you had a bond, and actually there's those of us in the field who actually sometimes disagree on using the word bond and attachment interchangeably, because I believe that the bond really occurs with the primary caregiver, and if you don't bond, after that everything is an attachment. So would you say you had a bond or an attachment with your biological mom?
I would say I had an attachment with her. I would not say it was a bond. I think bond goes deeper. There's love, there's affection, there's trust. So I would say I had an attachment to her and not a bond with her. I have a bond with my kids. I have a bond with my wife. It's completely different to me.
Okay. So it goes deeper. And probably on another program, we're going to talk about that because in our pre-interview, we talked about the whole spiritual aspect of a child. often being ignored. And that's a very important part, just as well as the mental and physical part.
Right.
Okay. So you're in the home, and all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, but gradually, things start to come to focus. And your story reminds me so much. Actually, I've asked my friend and colleague, Dan Smith, to be on this call because I told him that in reading your book, there were so many parallels to my experience as being a foster adoptive parent. I want to make sure that I stay on target because this is very emotional for me because at a certain point, I felt like I was reading my own story. So, Dan, I know you're there, so just jump in anytime you feel like it, because this is going to the part where I might drift a bit. But I remember when my son came, he was 9 years old, so he was even a little bit older than you, and things were fine, and our first encounter was from him stealing out of my purse. And yes. I was like, what is your problem? And, of course, he denied it. But, you know, a lot of things that that I experienced with him, no one had told me about. And I figured out what part of it was, and I think this was with yours. When you are not highly supervised, you get by with a lot more. And, of course, you've learned certain behaviors. But I was a single parent. He was the only child. It was just the two of us in the house. So I got to see everything, you know, witness practically everything sooner or later. And he wasn't getting away with the things that he perhaps had gotten away with before because he wasn't attached to anyone. You know, when you're in a house with six kids, you know, nobody pays that close attention to you, or you can always bounce it off and blame it on someone else. That didn't happen.
Right.
So, of course, when I would bring things to his attention, then that's where the lying and all of the other stuff began, and there was our journey.
Yeah. Yep.
It seems like it was similar in your case, that basically you were the only child. You had plenty of time to sit and think and conjure up things that you wanted to do and develop strategies. Did you say?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, and strategies, I did. I mean, there were times when my parents were, you know, maybe they were outside doing some work and I was inside. I'd have no problem going to my mom's purse and taking a couple of dollars here and there. I had no problem. You know, when I was old enough, around 10 or 11, they thought I could, or 12, they thought I could be left alone for a few hours in the house. One of my privileges that was taken away was watching TV. Now, the reason for that is because I was starting to become more interested in violence. I was becoming more interested in guns and knives, and they didn't want me watching anything that would promote any kind of violence because I would have nightmares. So they were looking out for my interest. Well, at that age, it was like, yeah, okay, whatever. I don't care. I'm going to do it anyway. And so when they told me not watching TV.
Part of the story, because this is what I highlighted that I wanted to read. Can I read this from page 67?
Sure.
This is in the chapter called Buying Friends. He says, when Dad and Suzanne were due to come home, I put a cold rag on top of the TV to cool it down. That is hilarious to me. I was not supposed to watch TV when they were gone. They didn't want me watching violent programs, as I was prone to have nightmares after seeing violence on television. I was also supposed to be doing my homework, so I thought that by putting a cold rag on top of the TV that I'd be able to keep them from feeling the heat it generated. I brushed my teeth, then crawled into bed. I heard Dad and Suzanne come in, and then heard Suzanne tell Dad that it didn't seem like I'd watch TV. My trick worked. I was really proud of myself.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing I did. I thought I was smarter than them, you know. Eventually, when they found out about the TV, I found a portable TV in the garage that I took to my room. Real small, black and white TV plugged into the wall, and before they were due to go home, I'd turn it off, hide it in my drawer underneath some clothes so they wouldn't find out. Well, the problem with that was I never kept my room clean, and so they got tired of asking me to clean my room. They finally cleaned it for me. And what do you think they found? They found the TV. So no matter what I thought, how smart I was, they were always one step ahead, and they found out in the end. Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait to speak to your mom and dad, because I'm sure perhaps they're laughing about this now, but I'm sure at the moment it was not funny. But
right.
I just think that's, you know, so resourceful. And, you know, we have to give kids credit that, you know what, you are really smart. You have the ability. You know, I would never have thought about that, but constantly going. And I always say, you know, the kids that I think are probably the most mischievous are our little geniuses. And when I have a child that's really acting out, I say, okay, here's one of our little geniuses here. And let me add this, too. I think when children, especially when they become adolescents, and they're like that, I really feel that some of the problem that adults, and especially those in the school system, have with them is that this child generally will challenge our own intelligence and ability to think. And we as adults are really intimidated by that. And I think some of that anger comes from feeling like we've been outsmarted.
Well, sure, and but at the same time, I think, too, is, you know, as adults, we think we know better. We think that we have the answers, we're more mature, we've been through a lot more. But we need to take the time to really talk to a child and not talk at a child. We need to get down on their level and really communicate with them on with words that they can understand and really understand what they're going through. You know, one of the big things that I found that really gets parents upset if they relish, you know, if they say, I want you to do this, and the child says, no, I'm not going to do that. And they say, oh, yes, you are. And the child says, no, I'm not. Well, all of a sudden, you have a power struggle going on. And one thing about these kids, especially myself, I loved power. I wanted to be in control of everything. So when the power struggle came on, that's what I wanted. And so a lot of parents, I find, are getting sucked into this power, control issue and this power struggle. And what they need to do, what I found out, is just, okay, you don't want to do it? Okay, fine. And leave it at that, you know.
However, there is a consequence,
exactly. And the consequence may be, okay, you don't want to go to bed when I ask you to, you're going to go to bed early the next night. You don't want to pick up your toys now, you lose those toys for X amount of days. Consequences have to make sense, and they have to fit the behavior going on. You know, it doesn't make sense, you know, if a child refuses to eat his dinner, you take away, you know, his dinner and he doesn't get anything to eat all night. That, to me, is a punishment. We never want to use food as any kind of consequence or punishment.
That's a basic.
Okay?
Right. Yeah, that's a basic
need.
I'm laughing because I just looked at the chat room, and your dad is in the chat room. He says, we finally found that TV, laughing now, but you and I watched the 89 earthquake on that battery-powered TV.
Yeah, we did. We sure did. Yep, the Loma Prieta earthquake. I remember that very well.
Oh, that is funny. That is funny. And, you know, and one of the things that I tell caregivers to do, to, one, get, you know, sometimes distance yourself and say, will this matter 5 years from now? Will this matter 10 years from now? What will I think about this? And sometimes we almost, to some degree, have to detach ourselves from it to not take it personally and to realize one day we're going to laugh at this. One day we're going to laugh at this. But I think for caregivers, besides those who are just, you know, authoritative in their styles, I believe that there are those who really genuinely want so much for the child, and they can only see it happening one way, and they operate out of fear. You know, I'm afraid this child is never going to be able to do this. I'm afraid this. And their hearts are in the right place, but they're without the tools or the flexibility to use a different method. And you definitely need support. You definitely need the support.
Absolutely. And a lot of times, too, these kids will act out and test these people to see if they're going to stick around, you know.
Yes.
What I find a lot at the group home I work at is when I first started there, these kids told me flat out, I hate you. I don't want anything to do with you. You're too strict and you're unfair. But as I was consistent, and I stress consistency very much, as I was consistent every day with the same thing over and over again, it soon went from I hate you to, you know what, I respect you. You're strict, but you're fair, and I respect it, and I like it. You know, because they tried, they knew I wasn't going anywhere. They knew that they can scream and yell and curse at me, and I wasn't going anywhere, and I wasn't going to take it personally. Now, that's very, very hard to do. I knew not to take it personally because I was one of those kids. However, like you said, a lot of parents out there take it personally, and it's very normal, and it's very understandable. We have to, you know, let the parents know, and I stress this enough, it's not personal. Do your best to try to not take it personal. It's easier said than done, I know.
Yep, indeed. Definitely so. Dan, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Would you like to?
Okay. No, I first thing I have to start off, Jesse, by just congratulating you on writing a book and being where you are at such a relatively young age. And it may seem to you like you've lived with this for a long time, but there are a lot of people that have lived with things a lot longer and haven't dealt with them. So congratulations. I read your book, and like Evelyn, I picked it up, and I couldn't put it down. One of the things that I was curious about, and I was never in the foster system, but there's a lot of things that were in your life that I can identify with. My parents were absent through alcoholism, and I, being the oldest, I learned to be responsible because I had to take care of my brother and my sisters. And at least I went home to the same house, and I attached, and I called it informal adoption. I grabbed fathers. I gravitated to them, and I learned from them how to be a father. And as I hear you now and as I'm reading your book, you learned to become the man you wanted to be. And out of all this chaos, out of all this inconsistency throughout your life, how did you manage to do that?
Well, in the beginning, you know, it took me a long time to form a bond and attach with my mom. I immediately flocked to my dad. I never had a dad figure in my life, so I immediately flocked to him. He taught me a lot. But as I grew older, I finally realized that, you know, I don't have any control over what happened in the past. I can take the past and turn it into a positive, not only for me, but as a teaching tool and a motivational tool for other people. I finally realized that my mom, who I had rejected for so many years and pushed aside for so many years, was only doing her best to try to guide me in the right direction. And then having three children of my own, they taught me a lot about being a father. If you don't have kids, and when you have kids, you'll understand what I'm saying. They will teach you patience. They will teach you love. They will teach you caring. They will teach you anything you want to know. And, you know, life doesn't come with the rule book. Life doesn't come with this is how you do things. You just kind of have to figure it out on your own. And if you're able to work through the issues you have in your past, you'll have a better understanding and a clearer mind to do that.
Yes.
Wow.
And it's interesting because that is something that we speak of often. You know, Dan and I, you know, are very close, and he's also one of our board members, but we're also part of a speakers network. And that whole issue of empowerment and making choices for yourself is a common topic, you know, and something that we come back to. So that is really, it's just amazing. And finding that place. One of the things I wanted to note that I noticed also throughout the book, there were some things, aside from things that people did, but environments and things that you were able to do that brought you a sense of calm. And one of the things I noticed that throughout the book came back to fishing and having, you know, being
yes,
around
mm-hmm.
water. You loved animals, mm-hmm. seemed to appreciate nature, just being out in nature, music, and reading. And I just
yes.
think those also important that unfortunately a lot of our children, especially in the inner city, do not have the opportunity to experience.
You're right. And the outdoors is very, very peaceful. Fishing is very peaceful. It teaches you patience for sure. Reading. To me, reading was my favorite. I could immerse myself into any type of fantasy book I wanted to. I can leave the world I was in and go into this fantasy world, and I would be just totally lose touch with reality around me. All my problems did not follow me at all. That was my favorite thing. I could get up in the morning, have breakfast, go to my room, sit down, open up a 300-page book, and be done with it by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. No problem. I'd take it outside. Reading, to me, was my ultimate passion. As far as music, I had a guitar, a classical guitar that my biological mother had given me. I messed around with it. I didn't really know how to play it. But as of today, I own several guitars. I enjoy playing my guitar. I play for my kids. I play for my wife. I sing to them. It's just, I can express my feelings and emotions through the music I play. I did play trumpet for many, many years. And again, expressing my emotions through the music I play was just something that I cannot explain. It was absolutely fantastic. And I wish more kids out there would have available resources such as that to be able to do those kind of things. I think it would help tremendously.
Exactly. And that is something that I'm really hoping to integrate into our services for our children. And actually, I'm meeting with a grant writer tomorrow to talk about exactly some of those things, because they themselves are healing and provide the space that a child can go to without having to go into that self-injurious behavior to be able to express the pain, the joy, the excitement, the confusion, the sadness, all of that. But speaking of reading, this is another one of my favorite stories, where you're talking about your teacher, Lonnie, on page 49.
Yes.
You said,
yes,
I love to read. I told my teacher, Lonnie, that I read a 300-page book a day, every day. Wow. The fact was, I didn't. I picked books from the classroom bookshelf and took them to Lonnie. I told him that I just finished the book. By reading the back of the book before I took it to him, I was able to put together a summary and add a few other little ideas from what I read on the back that sounded right. Lonnie fell for my trick, hook, line, and sinker. I got more stickers than anyone else. In fact, Dad and Suzanne even promised me $50 if I read the most books in my class. My trick worked for a while. I was getting so much praise from my teacher, from Dad and Suzanne, and from other kids at school. I felt like I was the most popular kid in class. I held my head high, and it seemed like nothing bad could happen. My game was short-lived, however, because my luck ran out. One of the books I took up to Lonnie was a book he had just read the week before. So when I summarized for him what I thought sounded good, he knew right then and there I had just made it up. When he confronted me about it, I got very defensive and continued to lie. I told him I had no idea what he was talking about. I pleaded and pleaded with him to believe me, and I swore I'd read the book. I even told him that if he didn't believe me, then maybe he didn't read the book. No matter what I said or tried, it didn't work. Getting caught in this lie ultimately led to more anger and frustration. My schoolwork, social life, and problems with my parents got worse after that. So that's one of the ones where you laugh until you cry, because, oh my gosh, you know, it's just hilarious to me, because you were convinced you were going to tell him something. Well, you know, don't talk about me. Maybe you're the one that's got the problem.
Right. Right, and you know, that's actually pretty common, too, is because we lie so much, we tend to believe what we say.
Yes.
And, you know, if you ever do something, if you keep telling yourself, hey, I'm, you know, smart, you're going to feel smart. If somebody keeps telling you you're not smart and you're not going to amount to anything, and you keep hearing it over and over and over again, well, you're going to believe it. Well, as you tell a lie over and over and over again, you kind of just start believing what you're saying, you know. And sure enough, you know, I knew there were times I didn't believe what I was saying, but I was going to do my darndest to make sure that I was as convincible as I could be, you know. But a lot of times, you know, one of my biggest lines was, I don't know. I don't know, you know. Why did you do that? I don't know. Yeah, I mean.
Let me read this one, because this is one of my other favorites. Uh-oh, I lost the page. Let's see. I don't know. Page 52. Okay, 53. This is with you and your mom. Hey, come back. Okay. I'm not sure what it was that you had done. Oh, you had stolen. And, stolen out of someone's car. That's what it was. I think that was your first big job, huh? Your first outside job. So basically you said, when I reached my house, I was immediately confronted by Suzanne. My dad was at work, but I was assured that he already knew about the incident and would be talking to me when he got home. Suzanne asked me why I got into the car. I felt confused because I just didn't know. Things just happened, and I didn't know why I did them. Of course, that was not the answer she was looking for. She told me that I must know, and she asked me again. I told her again that I didn't know. I began to get angry and defensive. I threw my hands out to my sides in a gesture as if to say, "What else do you want me to say?"
Hell yeah. Very
funny. I knew that there was something I wanted, and there was money, but I wasn't going to tell her that. I couldn't tell her that. It was almost as if my lips were frozen, preventing me from telling her what I was thinking. Oh, my gosh. I mean, this just, like, took me back, because I remember, why did you do it? Was there a reason? I don't know. And the shrug in the shoulders. Oh, my gosh. That just drove me into a tizzy. So I hear someone in the chat room, Karen says, we don't accept I don't know as an answer. And actually, I do that now. I could do that in the clinical film where I'm not as emotional in it. And I say, well, usually when someone tells me I don't know, that means they even haven't stopped to think about it because they really do know deep inside, or they really don't want to talk about it. So which one is it? And then with that, I usually get some type of response. But, oh, gosh. And I think the thing here is, you have to really love the kids to be able to go through all of this and to be able to laugh and not, again, not taking ourselves so seriously. That I don't know part. Now, you said there were times you lied and that you knew different, but other times, were there times when you really did believe your lies?
Absolutely. And that actually many times. I lied, and I actually believed my lies. There were times when I completely forgot about something, and I lied about it, or conveniently, let's put it that way, conveniently forgot about things. But, you know, one of the biggest issues also that I hear from a lot of people and that I can actually relate to myself is there's an inner struggle going on within us. You know, part of us knows we're not supposed to do that because we've been told we're not supposed to do that, okay? And then the other part of us says, well, I'm going to do it anyway because that's what I want and nobody's going to tell me anything about it. So if I go back to the issue about the car, I knew I wasn't supposed to get in the car because I knew it was somebody else's car. But I didn't care. I was going to do it anyway because I wanted to. And it's a very real thing that happens in some kids is they have this inner fight going on, and they revert back to, you know, their childhood years. Well, what did I do in order to get what I needed? What did I do in order to survive? Well, I did what I had to, and that's how they grow up to be. That's why they lie. That's why they manipulate. That's why they steal. That's, you know, all those reasons, because it's a survival mode that they're used to, and it just continues through childhood, through adolescence, and unfortunately can get worse if not stopped. One of the stories that I remember, and I'm not trying to scare anybody by all means, is my mother had called me on the phone a few months ago, Suzanne. When I refer to my mother, it's Suzanne, she's my mom, called me on the phone quite a few months ago and said, here, I got to tell you this story. I'm like, okay. It goes, and now this story is almost verbatim to what you went through. I'm like, okay, this will be interesting. And she says, this child, you know, was neglected by his mom. He couldn't form relationships. He was stealing. He was cutting. He was running away from home. Almost verbatim that what I went through. And she goes, do you know who that is? I said, I have no idea. She goes, that was Charles Manson. And my jaw dropped. If you could see my expression on the other side of the phone when she told me that, it dropped. Now, like I said, I don't want to scare anybody out there because, you know, I think Charles Manson was a pretty rare case, but those are the kinds of things that can happen if this issue is not addressed and worked through, as you know, in a certain amount of time, because mm-hmm. it can get worse and worse and worse and worse. I've talked to adults with reactive attachment disorder who just have no hope at all in life, who don't know what to do, who are very depressed, who still hurt themselves. It doesn't have to be that way. We can fix this. You know,
right.
It's going to take patience. It's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of work. You know, but we have to do it from our heart, and we must do it. We have to.
And, you know, there are two things came to my mind when you were saying that. One, you know, when people, especially when children seem to have no remorse, that's one of the first clues that we said, oh, my gosh, this is, you know, descriptive of psychopathic behavior. And, you know, and that's a personality disorder, of which generally people don't grow out of, and it intensifies. And so that's usually a fear. The other thing that you stated, well, let me back up. Because even with that, I was going to say, most of these behaviors, don't most children do them at some point that we're talking about for the reactive attachment disorder?
Say that again. I apologize.
I'd say many of the behaviors that we're talking about as being behavioral symptoms of reactive attachment disorder, wouldn't you agree that most children do some of these to some extent?
Absolutely. I think, you know, and again, the diagnosis, when you diagnose a kid, you know, and this is my personal opinion, you can diagnose a kid with reactive attachment disorder, with oppositional defiant disorder. You can look at a kid, one therapist can look at a kid and says, oh, he's got post-traumatic stress disorder. You could take him to another therapist and say, oh, he's got oppositional defiant disorder.
Mm-hmm.
You take him to a third therapist and he says, oh, no, he's just depressed. Here's some pills to take care of it, and there you go. And that's not the answer. You know, unfortunately, in the society we live in, it's not perfect. You know,
mm-hmm.
and I don't see it getting better because more and more I see kids, you know, in homes where both parents are not in the home, whether they're having to work, and there's not a lot of after-school programs, there's not a lot of supervision there for the kids, you know. And so, yes, a lot of kids out there can have symptoms of reactive attachment disorder. And there are also a lot of attachment disorders out there. You know,
mm-hmm.
some form of attachment disorder a lot of people have.
And you said something that was very important, and I found this out when I, you know, would treat kids and then send them for a psychological evaluation, you know, for testing, because somebody would come back with a whole different diagnosis. But I had this one psychologist that we were just so intuned. Without my saying, he would always pick up, and we never even met face-to-face, and without my giving him the diagnosis. But my point is that regardless of what you want to call it, it boils down to pain and wounded hearts.
Absolutely.
That's the bottom line.
Okay.
And regardless
of
what you call it, there's something underneath the diagnosis, and we need to go beyond the surface. And I know when you and I spoke earlier, we talked about people doing the cognitive behavioral therapy and, you know, the behavioral mode, which is good because it, you know, instills and reinforces certain positive behaviors. But you can't fix the inside from the outside in. You have to
Correct.
Go from the inside because that behavior, anyone can mimic behavior, work to get rewards and everything, but that doesn't change their hearts. That heart has to be healed. And I think that's the process, which the other word that you said, to fix it. And I think we both agree that kids are not to be fixed. They're to be healed
right.
and loved.
Right.
And that
right.
becomes part of the problem because a lot of adults think, you know, well, my role here is to fix this kid. No, your role is to be a healing agent and to love. And there's some tools that you can use because it's not just love. There's a quote that I have that said, where love and skill meet, expect magic. And that's why I started my nonprofit, because I felt that a lot of people, both the adoptive parents and the children, were being set up because people felt all they need is love, and they needed some more than just love. And especially when that
right.
adoption is final and the agencies are no longer involved, you need some support. You need some backup. You need some tools to use. And most
sure.
social workers have not lived in the that environment. So it's important, very important.
Yeah, I'm not discrediting any therapist out there, and I'm not discrediting, you know, psychiatrists. This book is just about my personal life and gives insight on a rad child, on what we thought, what our thought process was, and gives, I think, an answer to a lot of questions out there. You know,
mm-hmm.
and I hope that this book will provide the, you know, and I'm not speaking in third term person here, but I really sincerely hope that this book will help others who are like me, you know, be able to open up and be able to say, hey, it's okay to be who I am. It's okay to want help, and it's okay to cry and laugh and share feelings, you know. It's okay. You know, we're all normal. We're all, we bleed the same. We feel the same. We may have trouble showing how we feel, and we have may have trouble expressing, you know, verbally how we feel. But deep down inside, we're all the same, you know, and hopefully this book will put a few more at ease to be able to come out and say, hey, I'm like this too. Here's my story. And I think writing it down is such great therapy because it takes everything in your head, puts it on paper, and like it did for me, once I put it on paper, it was like no longer weighing down 50 pounds on my shoulders. It was really incredible.
Exactly. And I am so glad that you have written it. Before we go to questions, let's tell our listeners where they can find you, where they can order your book.
Okay. Well, my email is jhogsett, H-O-G-S-E-T-T, 80@yahoo.com. I also have a blog that's radjhogsett.blogspot.com. And then my book is available on amazon.com, barnesandnobles.com, buy.com, as well as you can order it through me. And if you order it through me, I'd be happy to enclose a personal message and autograph each one. And if you're interested in ordering from me, just shoot me an email, and then I can send you the details on how to do that.
Great. And that's jhogsett80@yahoo.com.
Correct.
And the blog is, okay, Jerry just put it for me. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. We're at radjhogsett.blogspot.com.
Correct.
Cool. Dan, is there anything else that you would like to bring light to or ask and share before we open up to our other listeners?
Well, it was interesting as listening to the end of the conversation here, and you and Jesse were expanding on this and broadening it out. I really felt myself being drawn in, and I started seeing things in my own life. And when Jesse, when you were talking about the adults doing the same behaviors, and I realized that as an adult, I have done many self-destructive behaviors, and they were really a poor form of pain management. And you know, overspending, overeating, over anything. And, you know, look at, you know, there's so many debt crisis management places being advertised, and it's, I don't believe it's as much because the economy is on a downturn as it is that we were trying to medicate ourselves through spending because we have all these things that we've carried over. So, you know, initially I was thinking that, you know, this was something that didn't impact me, but now I'm thinking it's levels. And, you know, that you may be at a level, just to pick a number, 5, and I'm at a level 3, but we still have many, many of the same symptoms. And what I got from this conversation is, to a large extent, the diagnosis isn't as relevant as really taking specific action and doing things to change your life.
Right.
You hit it.
You're absolutely right. Yep.
Yes, and you got the whole point of the title that I gave it. At the heart of and after psychiatric diagnosis is really not about the diagnosis. It's about what's underneath that, what's going on for the child. But sometimes
Absolutely. We
need to diagnose ourselves a point of reference from which to enter in if we want to go to that level. So that's awesome. Thank you for that, Dan.
Thank you, and I'm glad you asked me. My battery's dying, so I have to jump off. It's been a great call.
Thank you.
Pleasure
Thank
meeting
you,
Dan.
For input. Thank you for being there for me. I held it together.
You did wonderful.
Let's see. We have some people online. I'm going to unmute you one at a time. Actually, there's something on your phone where you can actually have the board to show your hand raised. So if you have a question, there's something that your phone may have told you, and I forget what it is because I never call on a net line, that tells you what to do to raise your hand for me to pick you out, to unmute you to talk. And if anyone in the chat room has questions, please jot them down now, and I will take a look. Are you in the chat room now, Jesse?
Yes, I'm in the chat room, yes.
Oh, yeah, I do see that. Okay. So if anyone has any questions, so I'm going to go through the callers and see just in case they can't wave their hands. We have someone calling from the 660 area code.
Yes.
Hi, welcome. Would you like to make a comment or ask any questions?
Well, I really have enjoyed listening, and I think it's wonderful. We have, I guess I have a question or maybe need some advice. We have two adopted children that we had since they've been 5 and 6. They're 17 and 18 now, and we are still struggling with reactive attachment. They are really tearing us apart sometimes, trying to pit us against each other, my husband and I. So I just kind of would like to have some advice. I mean, we've had them for 13 years, and it just doesn't seem to get any better. So I just want to see what advice you could offer us.
Well, I wish I could say that it's going to go away overnight, but to be honest with you, it's not. Unfortunately, you said they're 18. Is that what you said, 17, 18? Did I hear that correctly?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes. But they're
at
not
that age,
technically. They're biologically at that age, but they're kind of delayed. So
sure,
they're going to be with us for quite a while.
Okay. Now, have they've gone through therapy, and do you guys have like a therapist they go see? And
yes. Yes, we've been in counseling for 13 years. They've been in individual counseling. We've been family counseling. We have people that come to our home. You know, basically, we feel like we don't have anywhere else to go. You know, we've done everything that we, you know, tapped into every resource available. But, you know, we're just feel like we're pretty much alone trying to figure it out on our, you know, by ourselves.
Have you noticed any small changes, positive changes in their behavior at all?
They've got a combination of reactive attachment and oppositional. So when we say we really would like you to succeed in school, they're not going to do it. If we say please turn in your homework, you know, they're not going to do it. You know, so it's like everything that we say we'd like to see you do, they're definitely going to do the total opposite. So we don't even say, you know, what we want because we know it's not going to happen.
Okay, so here's my suggestion for that. And I actually use this suggestion with the kids I work with in the group home as of today. Okay, with oppositional defiant kids, they're going to tell you no matter what you say all the time. Okay, they want to be in control of the situation, much like reactive attachment disorder. So here's my suggestion for you. Mm-hmm. Any issue that comes up, offer them two or three or four different choices that they can make, all choices being appropriate choices. For example, if you go to the grocery store and say, okay, we're here to pick out dinner, you can pick out A, B, C, or D. What would you like?
Mm-hmm.
Let them pick it out. They have control over that situation, okay? If you're going to the store or you're going out, you know, or better yet, if you're at home, okay, there's dishes that have to be done, there's a room that has to be cleaned up, there's trash that has to be taken out. Now, if you ask them, hey, can you go take out the trash, what's their answer going to be? No.
No.
Oppositional defiant, right? Okay,
right.
So here's what you do. You say, would you like to take out the trash, would you like to do the dishes, or would you like to do this? If you do any one of these, this is what you get. Okay, you have to back it up with an immediate reward, okay? And that's how what we do in the group home. We do these little baby steps, with these kids.
Right.
We immediately back up any positive thing with an immediate reward. It could be a sticker on a chart. It could be a hug. It can be a verbal praise, something. But you have to be consistent with it. Okay?
Right.
Have to be. And number two is don't get involved with power struggles. If they tell you no, okay, fine. Move on to something else. You know,
we
it's
were just
to
listening to you say that because, you know, because we have two biological children that are older and we, you know, this is the way we raise our children and then we have these two that we have to do something totally different and, you know, it's, but yes, we're working on that.
Yeah, and any kind of baby steps, you may see just the tiniest of improvement. Build on that. Mm-hmm. Really lift them up. Say, hey, you did a great job doing this. Look at the little progress or the progress you're making. Don't tell them little, but look at the progress you're making. We're really proud of you. Great job. Keep up the good work. High five, hug, whatever. You know, build that up for them so they can see the confidence in themselves. And it's important as parents and caregivers and workers that we see the littlest of change in these kids. I think a lot of times we're looking for these big changes to happen overnight, and it doesn't happen this way. You know, it's the smallest of changes that we really need to pay attention to and build on those. So that's what I would try.
The other thing that worried me when you said the point about Charles Manson is because our older of the two does the lying, the stealing, the cheating, the manipulative behaviors. And we've been told, we've had gone through psychological testing, and, you know, we've been told, you know, we probably shouldn't even have him in our home. And we adopted him, you know, he became our child. We want to keep him. And at the same time, it's very scary, you know, because he does these behaviors. So, you know, sometimes it's hard to sleep at night when you're not sure exactly what his big deal is going to be.
Has he exhibited safety behaviors? Has he threatened you or threatened other people in the home?
Oh, yeah. From time to time, he set our house on fire. I mean, you know, but that was a few years ago. But it just comes on all of a sudden. So, you know, it's just, I don't know. We've been really trying to find reactive attachment, you know, more information because, you know, ultimately if we can help him, it helps us. So, and we live in a rural area where there's not much, you know, anything in our area for, you know, any help.
Sure, sure. Well, the best, you know, I would love to talk to you even more. I could talk to you for hours on this subject. I would say, you know, if you're interested in the copy of the book, definitely look at it because in the back of the book, there's about 144 different tips and suggestions in there to deal with certain situations that come up. That might be very helpful for you.
I will definitely get that, yes. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. Thank you, and hope you'll join us again. And actually, we're going to follow up this because, for one, during November, which is National Adoption Month, I haven't asked him specifically yet, but I'm going to ask for Daddy Hugs It, Donna Jerry, and Suzanne to join us to talk about it from the parental perspective. And we're going to also ask Dr. Brian Post, who specializes in issues regarding attachment and adoptive children, to join us during the month of November. So please, if you're on Facebook, go to For a Child's Heart, and our website is www.forachildsheart.org. You know, Jesse, you were talking about the whole thing about not getting into the power struggle. And one of the things that it's real interesting because you said, would you like to? And for me, in trying to foster relationship to get them, I know if there's no sense of empathy, there's a reward. Because one of the things I like to say is, I would appreciate, I would prefer. Because then I'm trying to make them like something, but we're developing a sense of empathy. So if you say, you know, would you like to do 1, 2, or 3? You know, they probably say, well, I don't want to do neither one. Well, so I would like for you to do that. And if you would, this is, you know, what I'm willing to do. Because I think they need to know that this is a reciprocal relationship. And you're going to get from me, you know, you receive, you get, you give, you receive. And to learn that there's an exchange. So that's one.
Right.
And then something I learned, one of the things that I learned while I was an intern that I've used for years, and it has always worked. And my supervisor told me it's Bushnell Hope theory. When someone, you don't have to give out in the punishment when you say, okay, if they choose not to do it, you don't get into power struggle. But eventually, and they're going to expect punishment. I know one of the things that you stated in your book was that, you know, you hated not knowing what was going to happen worse than anything. So they're walking around like, is she going to get mad? Is she going to go off? Am I going to get a restriction? Am I going to get a spanking? You know, what's going to happen? Finally, nothing happens. It's like, oh, but then eventually they're going to ask you for something. Can I have a privilege for this? And the answer is, I wish I felt okay about doing that. And it's not about can or can't. I wish I felt okay about doing that. But I'm going to say no this time. And I hope the next time when I ask you to do things, you know, like take out the garbage or do something, that you will remember this and that I will, you know, that you will do that and I'll feel better when you ask me about something. So that gives them a sense of hope. It gives them much clarity about why you're saying no, and it's focusing on their behavior and not them, and also letting them know that you want to give them things, you know.
Yes.
So that is one that it's never failed on some level. You know, of course, it's not going to change things overnight, but it gives them something to think about, and it keeps you from going off.
That's right. You got
it. Yeah, so we're empowered. We feel like we need to have some type of leverage.
Right. Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. I'm going to call on our next person if I did not put them off. Okay, let me get back to the studio. Let's see. We're coming right back. Okay, I'm going to put you. Oh, she hung up. Somebody hung up. Oh, okay, so you're still there, and I guess the person thought I was going to call them, so they were going to decide they didn't want to talk. Okay, let's see. We have an unknown caller. Are you there? Would you like to speak? We have a blocked number. You're on the air. Okay, I guess not. So, let's see. Okay, that's it. Somebody is gone. And I'm going to go back to the chat room. What's happening in the chat room? Everybody okay over there?
Let's see if people are answering here. I think they should be there. Yeah.
Okay. I got all excited and confused, so I've lost that screen. Okay, here it is. didn't come back immediately. Anyway, Jesse, give the listeners one more time your contact information.
Contact information is jhogset80@yahoo.com and then redjhogset.blogspot.com. And, of course, you can find me on Facebook as well, but don't ask me that address because I'm still learning how to figure that one out.
Well, if you have a Facebook account, you can just type in the little search area his name, Jesse Hogsett, or you can start to type in detached. And surviving reactive attachment disorder, and that will bring up that group page.
Yes.
So there,
correct.
That should work. And again,
perfect.
Our website is www.forchildsheart.org, as well as our Facebook, which is For Child's Heart, Inc. So we thank you so much, and I know we didn't even touch, but maybe a quarter or a third of your book.
Yeah, there's a bunch more.
Pardon me?
I said there's definitely a bunch more in there, a lot more information.
Yes, yes, yes. There's a note that says another chat room guest. Okay. And talk to me. Here? Okay. I'm not seeing what the message is. We have another chat room guest. Oh, do you want me to acknowledge our chat room guest, Karen? Karen Flass? Thank you for joining us. And we have a guest number 42400 and guest number 40030. So thank you for joining us. And you can always come back to the site where you're listening to this and listen to the archive. It should be uploaded probably within the hour. And then by next week or by the end of the week, it will be on our website, www.forchildstart.org, and you click radio show. And you can listen to the show and all our other programs that have been aired over the past year. And I'm just so grateful for everyone that has come forth to help support this. And we are a nonprofit organization. If you wish to be able to make a donation, you can also go to that page. You can click, make donation, and you can also join our mailing list to hear some of the upcoming things that we'll be doing. We also have a television program in which I will be interviewing Jesse. It's called Visions for Child's Heart, and it airs in Northern California, Central California, and the San Francisco Bay Area. So as soon as we can get that schedule, we'll be doing that. And there are many other things we're going to be doing. And I look forward to working with you, Jesse.
Me too. It was a pleasure. A lot of fun. I enjoy talking with you tonight and sharing my story, and I look forward to things to come. Absolutely.
All right. Take care, and God bless. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
Mother crying, these are children are dying.